Welcome to another episode of Mindcast. Today we begin a discussion on a very sensitive yet important topic about firearms and mental health. A huge topic that ranges from discussions around safety, gun control, the impact of having firearms, be it involvement in suicide, homicide, school shootings, a lot of different issues and also potential solutions for this national problem. Given the breadth and complexity of the issue, our goal today is discussing only some aspects of it. I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Dr. Greg Fritz, and also the president of Bradley Hospital, Dr. Henry Sachs. Thank you both for being here.
I'm very glad to be here. I'm an avid listener to the Mindcast podcasts, and I look forward to being part of this interesting conversation.
Thank you, Tanu, Joe. Our focus today is on basic knowledge about firearms, and our format will be slightly different from previous episodes. So let me start by explaining my background and where I'm coming from with regard to firearms. I'm a lifelong gun owner, and I spend way too much time in the fall with my dog and my hunting buddies out in the Midwest and New England hunting pheasants, quail, and other game birds. So I have shotguns and use them regularly and enjoy it. I'm also a strong advocate for gun safety and gun control. And it's been my experience that most liberal urban mental health professionals and parents are strong gun control advocates, but they have little knowledge or experience with actual guns themselves. And I've come to the conclusion that this is problematic for several reasons. First of all, obvious ignorance about guns undermines the efficacy of advocacy that we're trying to do. So gun owners, like most people, tend to write off people that they're talking to who don't know anything about guns but are talking about it. And then if there are mistaken assumptions that either the gun owners or the advocates have about the other group, that tends to make the conversation very polarized. Some people would say, well, we could just write off the gun owners, you know, and just make them do what we want. And that's not an effective approach. It's the old Willie Sutton principle that he was a famous bank robber and was asked, why do you rob banks? And the answer was, that's where the money is. Well, same thing with gun control. Where are the guns? They're with the gun owners. So we have to involve them in any conversations and change efforts at change that we want to bring about. So that's one problem. And the other is that, especially for mental health professionals, that lack of comfort and knowledge about guns can lead to perfunctory questions and superficial discussions with suicidal patients or with families of kids who are suicidal when we have to figure out if there are any access to guns that need to. So I think it's human nature that for all of us that if we don't know much about an area or a topic, what we want to do is get through it as quickly as possible. And that is not the kind of discussion that is most fruitful. So these are why I think it's worthwhile to know something about guns and why it concerns me that most of my colleagues don't. So I've cleverly devised a self-assessment test, which we're going to pilot in this episode of the podcast. And what I'm going to do is I have some hopefully interesting questions that I will pose to you as representative mental health professionals, stellar mental health professionals, and see what your responses are. You also have a lot of involvement with kids and that sort of thing. So your responses are pretty representative, I'll bet, of our profession. So, and then you'll give me your answers to these questions, and Marianne will keep a score, which we'll talk about at the end of the... So there's no abstaining from these questions. If you don't know the answer, you just take your best guess, okay?
Okay.
Look forward to this.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, I can see your... So here's question number one. Approximately what percent of gun owners belong to the NRA, the National Rifle Association? It's multiple choice. Is it A, 65%, B, 25%, or C, 5%?
I actually think it's a small percentage. I would have gone probably with C, 5%.
Okay, what would you say, Tanuja?
I was very hopeful. I thought 25.
Okay. The answer is, bing, Henry got it exactly right, 5%. And how we come to that is there's an estimated 100 million gun owners in the United States, people who, and they own on average more than one. And the NRA claims 5 million members, although this has been going down in the last several years with a lot of financial and leadership problems. But 5 million gun owners is 5%. But many times it's a common problem when to have gun control people assume that the NRA speaks for all gun owners. And that, for someone like me who hates that organization and thinks they're a bunch of fanatics, that's very problematic for to start a discussion. Question number two, this is true or false. Assault rifles are, by definition, military-grade automatic weapons that are more lethal than regular civilian guns because of their rapidity of fire.
Well, I'm going to say false because of your term military grade. I'm not sure they're all military grades. I'm going to say false.
We don't want to overthink this too much.
I would agree with that. The rest of the definition sounds about right.
So it is false. The assault-style weapons that we hear about and used all too frequently in mass shootings and school things are not automatic weapons. They're semi-automatic, meaning they have to pull the trigger each time that they want to shoot, as opposed to an automatic weapon, which is used in the military, where you pull the trigger once and they keep shooting until the gun runs out of ammunition. It's still possible to shoot quite rapidly with a semi-automatic weapon, but it's not an automatic. It's illegal to have anywhere in the United States for civilians to have an automatic weapon of any kind. So there's semi-automatic, automatic, and then bolt action or pump shotguns or rifles. Those you have to do something manually, whereas a semi-automatic or an automatic thing uses the force, the recoil of the explosion of the shell to eject it. Let's go on to number three. The ammunition that is commonly used in assault-style weapons and mass shootings is uniquely lethal, higher velocity, more destructive on impact, and more powerful than normal ammunition. True or false?
False.
For Anson, you say it's false?
I'm going to agree with her. I think it's false. That it's higher, it's more deadly than standard ammunition?
Yes.
I'm going to say false.
Okay, and you're both right. Why did you say that?
I think that more deadly ammunition, and I could be totally wrong about this, is actually more expensive and harder to get and probably maybe restricted in some way. But so that was my assumption.
The truth is that there's not all that much difference between military-grade ammunition and ammunition that's available and used by civilians. It's not the ammunition or the caliber that's different. Assault rifles often have interchangeable barrels that can use different calibers of ammunition, et cetera. So what I've said here, these last two questions, that neither the ammunition nor the mechanisms of the assault rifles are different from civilian rifles. What is different? Why are they used so commonly in mass shootings by people who are intent on killing a bunch? The answer is their looks. They look awful. They're all black. They have a pistol grip. They have a big metal cooling thing around the barrels, like military weapons do to cool it. They look macho, and they're often sold with macho accoutrements like flak jackets and stuff like that. And they have the big magazines that look like bananas. They call them banana magazine. So people who are feeling not empowered and vulnerable and want to make the biggest impact they can get a very fierce-looking weapon. But the point is, ballistically isn't significantly different than what's available all over the country. Well, anyhow, that's one reason that so much energy is put into banning assault rifles is because they are misunderstood to be military tools, and they're not. What's the fundamental difference between a rifle and a shotgun? This is question number four. A shotgun, three choices. A A shotgun always shoots multiple pellets with each shot, while a rifle shoots a single bullet. B, a shotgun barrel is smooth while a rifle barrel has a spiral groove. Or C, a shotgun is used only to hunt birds. Rifles are used to hunt mammals of different sizes.
I think I'm going to go with B, because I think shotguns can have, they can shoot single projectiles that are larger than a standard bullet. So that's what I'm going with.
I have no idea. So I will go with what Dr. Sachs is saying.
Okay.
I would guess the same, because his explanation sounds pretty valid.
That's a wise move. Henry seems to know, quite knowledgeable. That's the difference. It has the barrel has a spiral groove in it that makes the bullet come out spiraling like a spiral pass, like a quarterback throws, which makes it go further and then much more accurate, whereas shotgun just send it out. Send a wad of pellets, usually, but not always. It can, as you said, shoot a single.
So I did not know about the spiral groove, but of the three answers, that's the one that made sense.
You're the good test taker.
I'm the good test taker on that one, absolutely.
But that is the core difference. And so a shotgun is a very formidable weapon at close range, very formidable. But the pellets rapidly lose their energy and they spread out and go all over. So it's not after about 50 or 60 yards, it's not whereas a rifle can go miles or a mile easily. All right, question 5. High-capacity magazines or clips are readily available and legal in most states. These clips allow 30 or more rounds to be fired in rapid succession in most rifles. True or false?
I would go with false. I really hope that's true.
I'm going to also say false.
And the answer is true. High-capacity magazines are available almost everywhere. They were at one point banned with the law that was passed and sunsetted in 1994, and it hasn't been renewed. And there's really no excuse for high-capacity magazines. They serve no reasonable civilian use, and banning them should be a no-brainer. It's the first thing that should be done, and it's not happening. Although there are 13 states that have some relatively ineffectual and highly variable laws about the magazines and restricting them. Question number 6. Adolescents' immaturity and impulsiveness is recognized in most states by prohibiting gun ownership by those under 18 years of age. True or false?
I think that's false.
I'm an optimist. I hope that's true.
It's false. It's false in that adolescents in most states can own any long gun, a rifle or shotgun, as long as it is gifted to them by parents. They can't go to the store and buy one themselves, but they can own them and possess them if their parents give them to them. That's the case in most states. But adolescents can readily make guns from kits and with the advice of TikTok videos. These are what often called ghost guns in one way or another. And owning such guns is illegal, but very difficult to police. And adolescents, as we know, are by definition peer responsive and peer focused. They're impulsive and they often do things without the judgment that we'd expect of an adult. So clearly, adolescents, at least in my professional and in my gun owner opinion, should be prevented from owning and carrying weapons of any kind, firearms of any kind, without adult supervision. That isn't really the case either, especially in the inner cities and urban areas. We've got a huge problem with guns and their availability in the United States, and all the statistics which we could go into and we might some other time point to. Our problem is much bigger than other countries with regard to murders and homicides and suicides and impulsive behaviors and accidents. So, and teenagers are right square in the sight, so to speak, of all of these problems because of their developmental status. But it goes back to my first reason for doing this part of the firearm question is it's incumbent upon us as concerned professionals and parents to be able to advocate effectively for better gun control. The idea of having kids in college be able to carry concealed firearms is like, to me, that sounds crazy. But it's something that is happening in some states and some areas, and we need to work together with gun owners, responsible gun owners, to have things like this not be a pattern and expansion. So my advice to anybody who didn't get a good grade on this test or feels that they are uncomfortable and just clueless about ballistics or firearms is to spend a half an hour reading Wikipedia on gun mechanics, and you'll be much to the wiser when you do that and feel more confident. Anyhow, thanks for your participation in this.
Dr. Fritz, this was a very interesting discussion in that we don't spend enough time learning about firearms in general. And I think rightfully so, it's something you don't want to deal with. You don't read about it because you know it's unsafe and you don't want to, like, if you're not a firearm owner and you don't want to ever own firearms, it makes sense not to. But I totally appreciate the perspective that as mental health professionals, if you're advocating for safety, if you're talking about safety, you can do it more effectively when you have sufficient knowledge about the information you want to discuss and are equipped with enough data and research and information about the topic you want to answer when questions are asked to you by parents who have more knowledge about this issue. We can become effective advocates when we have enough information. So this is definitely a new perspective for me. And I absolutely learned a lot more than I knew before I walked in. And I also learned Dr. Sachs knows a lot more than I do. But I do have one question, Dr. Sachs. You take care of a lot of children and adolescents, like all of us have. How does this firearm safety conversation play out in real life, especially in situations where, you know, you're kind of catching on that the parents probably know a lot more than we do when we're talking about safety?
We probably have this conversation most at two points. One is someone's in the emergency room and they are at risk to themselves or others, and you have that conversation with the families in that moment. I think it tends to play out as a check-the-box kind of conversation to a large extent in most situations where the question is asked, do you have guns in the household? And it's a basically yes or no answer. And if the answer is yes, do you lock them up? Probably doesn't go much farther than that. And in general, I find sometimes we don't go down the path further of other potential access just outside the home. And then the other time is a discharge from inpatient or other settings where you might do a safety check with the family. And again, I would guess, especially here in Rhode Island in the Northeast, at least, that it's a relatively superficial conversation. It doesn't have the detail that might be helpful.
Thank you. That makes me think we kind of have to balance the nuance of this discussion, both for people who might feel strongly about owning firearms and for people who might feel strongly about not owning firearms. And both parties having young children in the home, we walk a very fine line. And learning more helps us have a detailed and nuanced discussion, as Dr. Fritz explained to us today. Dr. Sachs, how did it feel for you to be a part of this conversation today? It was definitely weighty for me.
Well, I think this is an incredibly important conversation. You know, the statistics we hear that there are over 300 million guns in this country at this point. So the idea of banning guns or not having guns is just not realistic. They're part of our environment. They're going to continue to be there. From my perspective, the goal here is how is we as a society, those who want guns, those who don't want guns, can work together to make sure that the environment that we have is as safe as possible and one that allows our children to grow up safely and all of us to grow up safely. That's what's the important message here. And I think that this kind of education is a critical part to having that conversation move forward.
So just like you mentioned earlier, our conversations can be superficial, but they are critical. And we have to balance out the information that we're giving and the approach to gun safety conversations, both for people who own them and who don't own them, because the critical issue is safety.
Absolutely.
Thank you. For our audience here, today's discussion on firearms and mental health may have been weighty, it definitely was for me, but it's a conversation that matters deeply to us as mental health professionals and individuals who take care of children and families. We hope this episode sparks thoughtful reflection and meaningful conversations in your homes. Creating a safe environment for our children involves open communication, empathy, and proactive steps to ensure their well-being, and that means all of us participating in that discussion. If you have any questions or if there are specific topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes, please reach out through Bradley Hospital's Facebook page. Our commitment to children's mental health remains steadfast, and your insights shape the direction of future conversations in our podcast. As we conclude today's episode, let's continue fostering a community that prioritizes mental health and safety of our young ones. Thank you, Dr. Fritz and Dr. Sachs, and to all our listeners for being a part of this important conversation. Until next time, take care, stay informed, and keep supporting the well-being of our children and families.